and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an attempt to understand the motives and strategies of the splinter group of the Pakistan Taliban, who claim responsibility for the Easter Sunday bombing of an amusement park in which over 70, mostly women and children, died and 350 were wounded. Shuja Nawaz, a distinguished fellow at the South Asia Center of the Atlantic Council and author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within, joins us to explain that while there is widespread revulsion at the latest atrocity, thousands of pro-Taliban demonstrators have gathered at the parliament in support of the murderer of a governor who was killed for his opposition to the broad blasphemy laws that are used to target Christians for execution. Then we'll go to Brussels, Belgium, and speak with Gilbert Doctorow, an American journalist who is the European coordinator of the American Committee for East-West Accord. He has an article at Russia Insider, Why Belgium, the Ugly Truth Behind the Brussels Bombing. And we will discuss how the North-South political division in the country between the Dutch-speaking North and the French-speaking South is hampering the government's ability to identify and combat homegrown terrorism, let alone prevent it. Then finally, Paul Son, the General Counsel and Program Director of the National Employment Law Project, joins us to discuss California's raise of the minimum wage to $15 an hour and how it might impact the national call for a raise in the federal minimum wage, now at $7.25 an hour, to $15, which Bernie Sanders has been championing. We'll discuss the likely economic impact of the projected raise for millions of low-wage workers, many of whom are single mothers supporting a family, and look into the politics of raising the minimum wage that has widespread bipartisan support across the nation. And joining us now is Shuja Nawaz, who is a distinguished fellow at the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. He's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. A native of Pakistan, he has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you, Ian.
And this hideous bombing that took place in Lahore, mostly the casualties are mostly women and children. A splinter group of the Taliban claimed responsibility for it, saying that they were targeting Christians on Easter Sunday. There were four young men trying to get into the park. They were stopped by a guard. Three of them ran away. One of them broke past him, entered the park, and blew himself up. So presumably, if the other three were armed with suicide vests, it could have been a lot worse. But what's your sense of how the government is handling this when the Prime Minister says our goal is not only to eliminate terror infrastructure, but also the extremist mindset, which is a threat to our way of life? That's a tall order, isn't it?
It is, and it's part of a very major list of activities that the government has identified under a national action plan. This is now in its second year, but it's making slow progress because a lot of the actual work needs to be done at the provincial level. This is, of course, a challenge for the government because it only controls the Punjab, which is the largest province. It doesn't control the governments in any of the other provinces, so it has to negotiate with them on what to do and how to do it, and also has to provide resources because the provinces quite often have a different set of priorities. So in the Punjab, this is the first major challenge by the right-wing Sunni groups from both sides of the divide, from the Bareilvi as well as the Deobandi groups. The Taliban, of course, are Deobandi. The Bareilvi groups are the people associated with the people who have been mourning the death of Mumtaz Qadri, who killed the governor of the Punjab, Salman Taseer. So they are now converging in their attempts to occupy public space and to get the government to capitulate to their demands. And so this will be a huge challenge for the Prime Minister and for his brother, who is the Chief Minister of Punjab.
Well, it's pretty hard to, at the moment where you've got all of this public outrage, which apparently is felt deeply across the country, to think that there are 2,000 protesters continuing their sit-in outside the parliament in the capital, Islamabad, protesting, expressing their support for this former police guard, Kadri, who was executed for the killing of the governor who had called for changes in the country's blasphemy laws. And not only do these people want the government to make Mr. Kadri an official martyr, they want to impose Sharia law and immediately execute all of those convicted of blasphemy. So give us a national picture, if you will, of how the occupation of the capital by these people relates to the widespread revulsion that the public itself feels. It feels like this is a problem here where the squeaky wheel gets the grease, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Well, let me throw another image before you. It's a bit like the frog in a pot of water that is gradually going to boil and doesn't leap out of it. And I think in many ways the condition of Pakistan is a bit like that frog, because successive governments have basically denied the immediate threat, the existentialist threat that is posed by the enemy within the country. While they talked about fighting terror, and they mourn the loss of civilian lives, and every year that has been the case, particularly the lives of Christians who've been attacked by the Taliban every year. And March 15th last year, two churches were attacked in Lahore. And then you go back to business as usual. So it's not just one government. It's successive governments, including the government of a military man, President Musharraf. They've all given space to the right wing to the extent where the right wing now is demanding more than just the loudspeaker. They actually want power. And the danger is that they have penetrated the police force. They may well have penetrated the military, which is a disciplined force still now. But, you know, if this continues, who knows where it may end up.
So it's very hard, though, to get an understanding of what the end game is here and what the purpose or the motivation for this massacre was, apart from just religious extremism, which is ill-defined in itself. Do you have any sense of what possible ideology or strategies involved here?
Well, on the part of the Taliban, it is basically to hurt the state, because they've been ousted from their territory in Fatah, in the federally administered tribal area that abuts Afghanistan. So they're now hitting soft targets inside Pakistan. They hit a school in Peshawar, and now they've hit this group. And as I said, every year they attack some Christian gathering or the other. But on the part of the Barelvi groups, it is really an attempt to seize political power and to change the laws of the land so that they would have greater control, which they have not been able to show through the ballot box. Whenever the elections are held, the religious parties don't do very well. But by using force and by basically shutting up the majority of the people through the threat of force and through their coercive activities, they feel that they can come into power.
And again, I'm speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who is a distinguished fellow at the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. He's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. And he's a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. So the Christian minority that are largely in the state of Punjab, where Lahore is, they are 2% of the country's 200 million population, roughly 4 million people. And they've been under constant threat, as you mentioned, with these continuing atrocities against them. Ironically, of course, most of the victims of this bombing were Muslims, but they were clearly, the Christians were targeted, and again, mostly women and children. My sense, though, is that as the U.S. and NATO wind down in Afghanistan and try and find a way to get out, the U.S. is sort of backing away from Pakistan. So is the anti-Americanism that's always been there, is that still a part of the kind of political narrative? In other words, you're saying that successive governments have sort of kicked the can down the road in terms of taking tough measures, almost trying to wish this away, but the war within gets worse and worse. And is that likely to accelerate, the extent to which perhaps what was happening next door and U.S. involvement was a kind of distraction, if you will, away from Pakistan's inherent problems?
Well, there will continue to be distractions. Afghanistan will remain a big issue because many of the Pakistani Taliban that were ousted from the border region fled into Afghanistan and tied up with the Afghan Taliban in many ways, and will continue to use that as a reverse sanctuary to try and attack the state of Pakistan. And on the eastern border, although talks have begun with India, it is not clear if that hostility is going to end anytime soon. But there is, I would say, room for some cautious optimism, because the Prime Minister and his party have taken support from others in launching a national action plan, which is a long list of various activities, including changing the mindset and the narrative and changing the curricula, reforming the madrasas. The 20 different items, not all of which are being attacked with the same ferocity that they deserve, but at least they're trying to work with different provincial governments. And so the military has been brought into action in Karachi in the province of Sindh to control terrorism and militancy both. And they have taken on the leading political parties there. In Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, there is, by all accounts, and I've just come back from Pakistan, my second trip in 5 months, looking at this national action plan. From all accounts, the provincial government of Imran Khan seems to be working well with the authorities, military and civilian, from Islamabad in trying to work together against militancy and terrorism. It's the Punjab which has been kind of silent in all of this, because there were allegations that the Prime Minister's own party had made electoral alliances in southern Punjab with the right-wing Sunni groups. And so that is now going to be challenged in many ways by the new activities that apparently the military has now launched by bringing in the Rangers, as well as intelligence-based operations where they picked up some people in connection with this bombing. We don't know if this will be a full-fledged operation where the 16,000-odd Rangers, or a substantial proportion of them, will be deployed in the heartland, or whether it will be primarily the 180,000 police of the Punjab. It's a huge population, though, Ian. It's 103 million people and just 180,000 policemen, most of whom are ill-equipped and ill-trained. So it's a huge challenge, but maybe the first steps are being taken, and maybe the Prime Minister can use this tragedy to galvanize support in the public for removing the voices that are dominating the public discourse.
And when you mention the madrasas, is there a role of Saudi Arabia? Because there's Saudi Arabian fingerprints over a lot of the radicalization in the name of Islam around the world, whether it's the Taliban, Boko Haram, or Shabab.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Saudis have played a role in, not officially funding, but there are other elements within Saudi Arabia that continue to fund the right-wing Sunni groups. And then, of course, Iran, which has been supporting the Shia minority, because it's not just the Christians that are being attacked, it's the other minorities too, whether it's the Shia, who are a substantial minority, roughly 20% of the population, or the Ahmadi sect, who were disbarred from calling themselves Muslim. They're another minority that is under attack, and indeed the demands of the protesters in Islamabad are that they should be thrown out of all government jobs.
And, of course, the Sufis have always been the target of the Taliban and the right-wing groups.
Yes, and this is the battle between the Deobandi and the Barelvi. Mm-hmm. The Barelvi are supposed to be the mystical, spiritual group, which includes the Sufis. Mm-hmm. But now the Qadri's followers are Barelvi, and mm-hmm. they have chosen to go on the warpath. So I think there are splits within these groups, and so it's not just the Deobandis fighting the Barelvis, it's the Barelvis also fighting the Barelvis, or the Deobandis fighting their own people.
Well, what's so depressing, though, is that they're fighting almost, it's not as if you can even deal with the blasphemy laws, because if anybody like this governor does support them, he gets executed, and then they go and protest and want to make a martyr out of the guy that killed him. So
exactly. They
are so much more proactive than the government, aren't they?
Yes, and this is really where I think control of the public space is something the government needs to think about. While I was there on February 29th, when the funeral of Mr. Qadri took place, the government did enforce a new law under which the media channels, the broadcast media channels particularly, couldn't provide live coverage of such demonstrations. And so that really was a mixed blessing, because people had no clue what was happening in different parts of Rawalpindi and Islamabad. Even I was trying to get to a meeting in Rawalpindi, and somebody had to call me to stop me from coming, because they said your car will be attacked and smashed by the protesters. So it works both ways, but I think there is an attempt now to somehow muzzle their ability to raise their voices and to get support from all over the country, as they're doing even as we speak, by inviting supporters to join the protest in front of the Parliament building in Islamabad.
And just in the last couple of seconds, what's the alternative or counter-protest with this widespread revulsion felt across the country?
I think at some point civil society needs to decide, is it going to support the government's efforts, and if so, how? And the business community will need to stop sitting on the sidelines also and provide support for civil society groups that want a Pakistan that was conceived in 1947 as a place where people from different religions as well as different sects could function together rather than be an exclusionary state.
Well, Shuja Nawaz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who's a distinguished fellow at the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. He's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. And he is a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Brussels, Belgium, to speak with an American journalist about the ugly truth behind the Brussels bombing. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gilbert Doctorow, who is a U.S. journalist based in Brussels, who is the European coordinator of the American Committee for East-West Accord. He is the author of Does Russia Have a Future? And has an article at Russia Insider, Why Belgium? The Ugly Truth Behind the Brussels Bombings. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gilbert Doctorow.
Thank you for having me.
And already there is a sort of somewhat confusing security picture emerging in Belgium, not the least of which in Brussels there are 19 communes with 19 mayors, 6 police departments, plus a federal police department. But on top of that, as you point out in your article, there is a north-south divide in the country itself between Dutch speakers in the north and French speakers in the south. So Is that, I guess, a broad explanation for why there's a lot of criticism about the Belgium?
Your last remarks bear on the first remarks. That's to say, the reason why we don't have a unified municipal government in Belgium, and the reason which hampers effective policing and effective municipal services in general, is the first point. According to the we have language laws here in Belgium, and we have a region of Flemish speakers, that is Flanders. We have a region of French speakers, that is Wallonia. And then we have the region of Brussels, the capital, and that is the bilingual territory. The only problem with that bilingualism is that 95% of the inhabitants of Brussels are French speakers, and 5% are Flemish speakers. And by the way it works, if we had a municipal government that covered all communes, that would have to be divided in power, 50% of the seats to the French speakers and 50% to the Flemish speakers. And that doesn't work. So for that reason, we have no effective municipal government. We have 19 separate communes which divide up the seats as they see fit.
But the people who seem to be getting the most of the brunt of the criticism are the Minister for Justice and the Deputy Prime Minister, who also holds the portfolio for internal affairs and security, Jean Jambon. And he apparently, they both offered to resign, and the Prime Minister has refused to accept their resignations. Mm-hmm. But Jambon, you paint a rather dire picture of him as having expressed sympathy for wartime collaboration with the Nazis. He belongs to a Flemish separatist party. And I'm just curious to know that there was a big demonstration of right-wing thugs, I guess is the more correct way to describe them, who were sort of hosed out of the main square where the commemoration for the victims are. So how does it work where you have the right-wing justice minister who appears to have screwed up badly defending his position and criticizing the socialists for being too liberal in the vein that I guess Tony Blair, the ex-Prime Minister of Britain, referred to as flabby liberals?
Yeah, well, the Belgian politics is not checkers, it's chess. And it's a complicated story. I don't want to bore your readers with your listeners with it. But the point is that you have a left-right divide, and you have a French and Dutch divide. And if all of these different interests have to be accommodated when they form governments. In the case of Jambon, he is a protege of the leader of the Flemish party, the new Flemish Alliance, and that is a separatist party. It is to speak of them as being affiliated or interested in the neo-Nazi issues is sad but true. I'd say in the case of Jambon, it was not my judgment on him. I was repeating in my article what French parliamentarians were saying about him because of some very unfortunate remarks he made right at the outset of the present administration, federal government, soon after he was appointed. And there is this little bit of off odor on the part of the Flemish parties, with going back to history, going back to the divided country during World War II, and the way the occupation was viewed in the different parts of the country. So yes, the recriminations that are ongoing up to this very last minute. It isn't just one or two mistakes or faux pas that Mr. Jambon made in not taking cues properly from intelligence that came in from abroad, from Turkey in particular, regarding suspects who then committed these heinous crimes at Zaventem and the Metro. Even this last weekend, yesterday, Sunday, we had the skinheads in town, and there the mayor of Brussels, who happens to be a socialist and a French speaker, of course, he came out very angrily, but against the failure of the Minister of Interior to prevent the arrival of these thugs to Brussels, which was entirely within his power since they came by train and the police on the train report to Mr. Jambon. So you find right up to the present moment that recriminations are coming out between the socialist French and the center-right Flemish, who are the power brokers in the current cabinet.
But I find it odd to be in a situation where, being a civil libertarian, I'm critical of too much sort of what's often called political correctness in policing. But it is mind-boggling to think that one of the terrorists who blew himself up at the airport had been involved in a robbery in which he fired a Kalashnikov at the police, and yet only got a 12-year sentence, four of which he served. And when he was on probation, he went down to Syria, where he tried to join ISIS, and the Turkish authorities arrested him and deported him back to the Netherlands. And as the Prime Minister of Turkey recently announced in a statement that embarrassed the Belgian authorities, that they alerted the Belgian authorities along with the Dutch authorities about who this guy was and what he was up to. That part
these
of
types of these elements of political culture, they go with the hemline. And I'd say, just to put it in the context that would be easy to understand in New York, I hope you get this in California, we've got a situation, a political climate with respect to the courts that is in the Mayor Lindsay period, the 1970s in New York. It is certainly pre-Giuliani. The administration of justice and the enforcement of law is very lax, very tolerant, and now that tolerance, which by itself is praiseworthy, is yielding some disastrous results in inability to control this jihadist terrorism.
Again, I'm speaking with Gilbert Doctorow, who is a U.S. journalist based in Brussels. He's the European coordinator of the American Committee for East-West Accords, and he's the author of Does Russia Have a Future? And he has an article at Russia Insider, Why Belgium, the Ugly Truth Behind the Brussels Bombing. So turning to these, you know, one of the things that's embarrassing, we are having an extremely embarrassing time here in the United States, in case you didn't notice, about the presidential races. One of the Republican candidates called for patrolling and policing Muslim neighborhoods, even though we don't have Muslim neighborhoods in the United States. But you do there in Brussels, and many of the analyses that one hears about why these homegrown jihadis turn against their government, their own state, as well as launch attacks to France next door. Unemployment is often cited. What's interesting, though, of course, is that most of the perpetrators do seem to be petty criminals. I don't know whether they get radicalized in prison or not, but it's hard to see how deep their ideology is. But what is the explanation for why people come to Belgium, presumably because they're escaping from countries that are incredibly oppressive? Either Middle East countries, by and large, are either run by military dictators or you know, rigid theocrats.
All right. Well, let's keep our sights on Belgium. The Muslim population here has been predominantly Moroccan, and indeed there is this element of political refugee status because Morocco is an authoritarian state. But it is not a draconian authoritarian state. It is not a state at war. It is not a state of obvious suppression of people. Still in all, there are people who find the European climate to be more freer and who find self-expression here that they couldn't have at home. That we grant them. But let's not bring in other elements from the Middle East. These are not refugees. They're not recent arrivals who are committing these crimes. They are Belgian born or Belgian raised. They are French speakers. They could be integrated in the society, and they're not. And this results from errors of omission and errors of commission. On the omission side, we've got this unemployment issue. But it's not an issue that's limited to the pockets of Muslim population. And the single biggest commune, which was the breeding ground of the perpetrators of these latest crimes, is Molenbeek, where 32% of the population is, in fact, Muslim. And a youth employment rate of 25%. That being said, it has to also be acknowledged that the 25% youth unemployment rate through the whole of Brussels. There has been for decades. That's a separate problem, but it's a problem that impacts on the particular alienation in the Muslim community. The second factor in influencing alienation is by commission, what Belgium has done. It is blowback. The Muslim community here was not very happy by the participation and very visible participation of Belgium armed forces in almost every military intervention in the Middle East and North Africa since 2000. And they have not been consulted. There has not been any particular effort by the Belgian authorities to find accommodation with those who are unhappy and who are protesting this foreign policy of Belgium. So these issues are very real in the community. And on top of that, you have a tolerance which looks at times like cowardice and looks at times as dereliction of duty on the part of the authorities. They do not enforce the laws that exist on residents. There are whole buildings in Molenbeek which are known to be hostels. That is, people sleeping on sleeping bags, people who are transient, who are not registered with the authorities, which is in direct violation of the residency laws in Belgium.
Well, one could hold George Bush and Dick Cheney responsible for much of the disasters that have happened recently in the Middle East, but it's still pretty hard to understand why people who have gone to a country that's far more hospitable and has a higher standard of living and a better life for them and their family would be that motivated by what happened in the Middle East or who was responsible for what happened in the Middle East. In the case of Belgium, I guess they were a part of that coalition that got rid of Gaddafi. I don't know that they had much to do with the – maybe being part of NATO, they would have been involved in Afghanistan.
This is a very complicated story, and I don't. Again, it's very difficult in a brief time to go through all elements. But I'd just like to introduce one more element for your audience to consider, and that is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has here in Belgium, as elsewhere in Europe, financed mosques to propagate their extremist Wahhabi Islam. And that is another factor which cannot be ignored. Although I've spoken in my article about the predominance of the French-speaking areas for settlement by immigrants from Morocco and North Africa within Belgium, it cannot be denied that there have been cells of radical jihadis in Antwerp. A group called Sharia for Belgium came up in the news in the last couple of days. You could have spotted it. And one of the suspects in the Saventem bombing had been named as part of this group. And so it's not a Molenbeek. He is not from Molenbeek. He is from the north, which is an exception to the generalizations which I have given.
So once again, the fingerprints of the Saudis, and we are in such deep denial here in the United States about the role of Saudi Arabia using their petrodollars to radicalize Islam around the world, and their connections are clear to the Taliban, to Boko Haram, to al-Shabaab, to al-Qaeda, to al-Nusra, and now to Daesh, the Islamic State. That's a whole – we could spend a day talking about that.
In the States, readers of The New Yorker would have been treated 1 year ago. In June 2015, there was an article by Ben Taub about jihadism in Belgium. And this very issue, this question of the mosques and who's paying for them, he mentioned that in passing.
Sure. Well, let's get to the scary part of your article, Gilbert Doctorow, and that is where at the end of the article you say that the jihadists in Belgium, their main objective was and likely remains Belgium's nuclear installations. And we learned from the murder Thursday evening of a guard at one of Belgium's nuclear plants whose electronic pass was stolen. That raises this whole specter to an extraordinarily high level. And the idea that presumably they were looking for nuclear material in order to make a dirty bomb, that's one of the great nightmares. So where does that stand in terms of, one, concrete evidence of a plot, and two, whether these plotters are still active and that the plot is still alive?
Well, presumably they're still active because nobody has identified or arrested the perpetrator of the murder of a given guard. nor has there been too much work following up the surveillance, the camera surveillance of a leading Belgian nuclear researcher.
The assumption was they were going to kidnap him, right?
Yes, yes. Nobody in the States had much imagination that you could blow up the Twin Towers by flying planes into them. So it is here in Belgium and in Europe, in Northern Europe, there are many objects, many different civil constructions that are extremely important and extremely vulnerable. And just a little bit of imagination would alert you to the vast damage to the economy or to health or to both that could come from attacking these targets. One of them, yes, is nuclear. Another is just down the way. It's the tunnel under the channel. Maybe if someone were to find a way to damage that, you could have $100 billion or more of damage in one go. Now, I raise these points of the potential damage and potential threats that are here under our noses, because the issue today in Belgium is, the policing to do this properly will have to hire some more policemen. That's going to cost a lot. And this inability to face up to the economic and administrative challenges of containing this existing, real, present jihadi threat is being measured in nickels and dimes, when the damage that could happen from a failure for them to get through the way they did in Zaventem is vast and unfathomable. Here's where the very halting, very weak government that we have is a very sad commentary on present-day Belgium.
Well, just in closing, within the Islamic communities themselves in Belgium, I assume that there's enough people there, the majority, I imagine, who really appreciate the country, want to live there, want their children to grow up there. And, one of the tragedies that's happening here in the United States with people like Donald Trump and Ted Cruz running for president, they're alienating the very Muslim community here in the United States that have actually integrated, as they have not done in Europe, apparently. But the idea that you would alienate the very people that you need to work with is counterintuitive.
I live in downtown Brussels, and a 10-minute walk from my house, there is a Portuguese community, there is a Moroccan community. The fish sellers are Moroccan. The greengrocers are Moroccan. Moroccans are generally considered in Belgium and have been for decades to be enterprising and solid members of the community. So the latest turn of events and the revelations about this jihadist radicalism are unexpected to the general population and are very disappointing. And it would seem as though it's high time that what has gone wrong be looked at very closely.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Gilbert Doctorow.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Gilbert Doctorow, who's a U.S. journalist based in Brussels. He's the European coordinator of the American Committee for East-West Accord, and he's the author of Does Russia Have a Future? And has an article at Russia Insider, Why Belgium? The Ugly Truth Behind the Brussels Bombings. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the national implications of California's raise in the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Paul Son, who is the General Counsel and Program Director at the National Employment Law Project, a research and advocacy organization focused on workforce policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Son.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And Paul, it looks as though the governor of California, Jerry Brown, and the legislature in Sacramento have reached a deal. I believe the governor also had a press conference today announcing the deal. And I take it the problem up until now was Brown wanted a kind of exit strategy in case the economy faltered. They've agreed to that. So is this pretty much a done deal?
It sounds like it. I mean, as you noted, the governor had his press conference, and I think all the reports are that this is an agreement that will move through the legislature. And it's, it's really a landmark that will mean broad raises for more than one in three workers in the state, reversing decades of growing wage inequality.
Well, the federal minimum wage, of course, still remains at $7.25 an hour. So when we're talking about $15 an hour, not that it's going to happen right away, and it's staggered over, I think, what, up to almost a decade, isn't it?
It would be by over 6 years for most workers, and then over 7 years for workers at businesses with fewer than 25 employees.
So it's still a while off, right, to 2022, right?
That's right, 2022 for most employees and 2023 for employees at small businesses. But it would be a very gradual phase in that shows that it's a very moderate proposal that will give employers ample time to adjust. But one shouldn't understate the broad beneficial impact. I mean, one in three California workers will get raises, and once it phases in entirely, it would be on the order of about $4,000 more per year for each affected worker on average. And these are for workers that are typically making $20,000 a year or less. So that is a very dramatic increase that will go a long way towards reversing the trend of falling wages that we've seen over the past several decades.
And when you refer to these workers who are earning $20,000 or less, are they either men supporting a family or single mothers supporting a family?
So the typical worker who will get a raise is a working woman over age 25. On average, she works full-time. On average, she actually has some college coursework. About 30% actually either have bachelor's or associate's degrees. And on average, she provides half of her household's income. You know, only a very small percent, 5% or fewer, are teenagers. Approximately, I think it's about a third of working mothers will get raises in the state. It's a very sweeping set of increases, and the prime beneficiaries are working adults who are supporting themselves and providing, on average, half of their household's income on these low-paying jobs. And the types of jobs are there jobs like waitresses and retail clerks and home health aides and security guards. I mean, the caregivers in particular, like home health aides, are one of the most significant populations affected. And these are workers that provide, crucial caregiving work. The median age is quite high there. I think it's well above 30 years old. But they've been, very, very underpaid for so many years, which is both, kind of ironic and unsustainable, and also really compromises the quality of care they provide, because it results in very high turnover rates for workers in those jobs.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Son, who's the General Counsel and Program Director at the National Employment Law Project, a research and advocacy organization focused on workforce policy. So I mentioned, Paul, that the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. The U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who's running for president for the Democratic Party, he's been calling for a raise in the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour by the year 2020. What's the likely fallout of this California? It's often said that California leads the nation. Will they lead the nation in this regard?
I think almost certainly. The impact of the California agreement is to cement $15 as the national benchmark for a strong minimum wage. As I think you've reported, you know, New York is attempting to negotiate a similar deal and may well do so this week. Other major states like New Jersey have lawmakers there have announced plans to put the same $15 increase on the ballot there next year. There's really growing national momentum, and you know, it really traces back to the fast food workers who launched this fight for 15 about 3.5 years ago. And when they did, I don't think anyone, you know, would have predicted that their proposal for a $15 wage, which was, you know, what they rightly indicated is what an individual single worker needs to support him or herself in most regions of the country, would start to become public policy just a few years later in the largest economy in the nation, with other major states likely to follow. If New York goes, the result will be that 19% of the U.S. workforce will be covered by $15 minimum wages, and I think at every level you're just going to see support for these significant wage increases grow.
So when Governor Brown was warning back in January of a $4 billion a year increase in the state budget if these public sector care workers that you mentioned about get a raise, how is that going to be accommodated, that shortfall? In other words, the theory, I guess, is if you raise all boats, there's more tax revenue coming in, et cetera, more consumption. But how do you answer? Obviously, Brown's concerns have been answered because he's agreed. But how would you answer them?
Well, I think the state budget has been growing steadily, is projected to keep growing. But what Governor Brown's budget office's what their assessments did not take into account is that as one raises workers' wages, there actually are very significant savings to the Medi-Cal program, to state Medicaid, as a result of. As workers who earn more money getting shifted from state Medicaid, which is 50% paid for by the California budget, to Affordable Care Act programs, Affordable Care Act expansion Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act exchanges, which are 90% or more paid for by the federal government. And so they're actually the governor's budget estimates didn't take that into account. So there are actually hundreds of millions of dollars in offsetting savings that will be generated very directly for Medicaid as a result of the wage increases. But then in addition, the increased consumer spending that will be generated by the higher minimum wages is very, very significant. It's in the tens of billions of dollars, and it will be a real boost to the state economy. California-based economists at the University of California, Berkeley are the leading researchers on this, who have modeled the impact that these higher minimum wages have on state economies, and they've found that the increased consumer spending offsets the higher cost to businesses. So the result is businesses are able to adjust to a higher minimum wage without any appreciable adverse effect on jobs.
Well, I've seen a lot of coverage of this, and the corporate media, of course, which is usually owned by businessmen and therefore is business friendly, often says that this is going to cause prices to rise and that the consumer is going to have to pay for this. And there was an interview on TV last night I was looking at, a woman who was a waitress getting $10 an hour at a kind of Denny's type restaurant where she probably doesn't get a lot of tips because, you know, the bills aren't that big. She was arguing against it, saying, oh, it's going to be terrible. I mean, it's pretty hard for me to understand. You know, it goes back to a general kind of observation that in the U.S. workplace, workers themselves are often not very pro-union, and the results speak for themselves. So, but nevertheless, what's your sense of these arguments that are coming out that either – you know, it's just the sky's going to fall if then the consumers are going to end up paying more and therefore going out to restaurants less.
Yeah, so, I mean, the best economic evidence shows that this gradually phased in minimum wage is going to be manageable and not going to have that effect on consumers or the economy. I mean, first, the price impact of transitioning to a $15 minimum wage is really quite modest. The University of California economists have estimated it's really just a fraction of a percent a year. And the reason is because of the basket of goods that most of the consumers spend their money on. There are only a relatively few portions of it that employ a lot of low-wage labor. Overall, the portion of of the cost structure that results from low-wage labor is small, and so the net inflationary impact of raising the minimum wage, even very significantly, is not that great. It's and much smaller than the projected annual rate of inflation for the next few years. And then on businesses' ability to adjust, I mean, I think another key indicator is the growing numbers of individual companies and business organizations that have stepped out to endorse the $15 minimum wage. And in my home state, New York, where I'm based, there are more than a half dozen trade associations have backed the $15 minimum wage. Cumulatively, they represent more than 32,000 small businesses in the state. There are a number of in California too, leading businesses that have endorsed the governor's proposal. And actually, interestingly, recently the CEO of the Popeyes fast food chain was one of the business leaders who said that he thought too much of a big deal had been made about in the fast food industry about the $15 minimum wage, and they commented that it would be adjusted to as other changes in the business environment are adjusted to.
So does anybody know whether this means, you know, what's the ratio between how much costs go up and how much profits go down? Because one gets the impression that a lot of the people who are complaining have very profitable businesses, and it just gets to this general question of income inequality in this country that Bernie Sanders has been talking about, is that maybe the rich can, since they've had it so good for so long recently, maybe they can afford to take a little bit less and spread the wealth a little bit. So does it really enter into that broader category?
No, you're absolutely right that virtually all of the benefits of growth have gone to owners and managers of firms. That very very little of the productivity gains of the past decades has been shared with workers. And Governor Brown's $15 minimum wage will begin to reverse that. And so probably a portion of the higher cost does come out of trimmed profit margins. So there's a small portion through adjusted prices. There's a large portion is covered through efficiency savings when the minimum wage goes up. Worker turnover goes down. Workers stay on the job longer. That saves employers money. But the biggest offsetting savings is the huge amount, the billions of dollars in new consumer spending that will be unleashed by workers receiving these raises. And again, the University of California and modeling shows that impact is so substantial with a $15 minimum wage that it largely offsets the higher costs to businesses.
Well, we learned, for example, in the last election that in Arkansas, the Democratic senator lost because he didn't embrace the raise of the minimum wage to $15 an hour, whereas the Republicans won because they did. So it's an interesting paradox, isn't it, that there's a recognition amongst politicians that this is very popular with a broad majority of the American people, not just on the left, but on the center and then on the right.
No, you're absolutely right. It's among Democratic, Republican, and Independent voters, raising the minimum wage is very broadly supported, and there are increasing numbers of kind of Republican Party strategists that are commenting that it's really not good politics or humane economic policy to be against raising the minimum wage. You know, people like Haley Barbour or last cycle Rick Santorum or even Mitt Romney have attempted to moderate the party's position on the issue because it is so broadly popular across the political spectrum.
Well, where does Trump and Cruz stand? Do you know?
So I think Trump has called for has opposed any increase, and I'm fairly certain that Ted Cruz has as well. So they will set up there's a very sharp distinction between their positions and those of the Democratic candidates who both strongly support a minimum wage increase.
So just in closing, then, Paulson, what's your sense of how this will pan out? We mentioned earlier that California leads the nation, and therefore it's likely to become a bigger issue at the federal level and perhaps a campaign issue. And that's where I wonder. I think Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are pretty much on the same page, although Sanders has championed it, I think, a little longer. What kind of political fallout will there be if, as we just mentioned, that both Trump and Cruz oppose it, whereas Sanders and Hillary are for it? Who's going to be punished and who's going to be rewarded?
Well, so I'm not a political prognosticator, but I think it's one thing's for certain is that the California action is going to continue to elevate this issue as the top economic question going into the 2016 election, and it's low-wage workers have become increasingly politically active, and I think with California approving a $15 minimum wage, New York very possibly following, we're going to see this become one of the key national economic policy debates and demands going into the fall, and it's not going to go away. And I think those who attempt to switch the topic from action on the minimum wage, do so at their peril.
Well, let's hope that these people who have been whose lives will be improved, albeit sort of marginally. It's pretty hard to believe that anybody can live on $20,000 a year, let alone raise a family. But as you pointed out, the majority are single mothers, and they could sure do with some help. So let's hope they also vote. I mean, that it's not easy to vote in this country. If they made it a public holiday, it'd be a lot easier. But working mother taking care of kids can barely afford childcare. I don't know when she finds time to take off a few hours from work to vote.
Our voter registration and electoral systems are deeply broken in many regards. But with the public that does vote, dependably in presidential years, raising the minimum wage is one of the most popular public policy issues. And candidates that oppose action really are swimming, against the political tide.
Well, Paulson, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Paulson, who is the General Counsel and Program Director at the National Employment Law Project, which is a research and advocacy organization focused on workforce policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.